Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the Bus and Rail Subcommittee meeting today on Monday, December 13th, 2021. To begin with, please note that this meeting is being recorded. The audio of the meeting will be placed on our website, which is wmata.com. As you know, that we do have interpreters with us on this call. Before speaking, I would request for you to please state your name. This helps them knowing who the speaker is. It also helps everyone on the phone call to know who the speaker is at the time. Just a few helpful tips. Anyone joining via phone call, just as I am today, you can press star 6 to mute and or unmute yourself. If you'd like to make any comments, you can raise or lower your virtual hands by pressing star 9. Everyone on the video conference, you can click on the speaker icon or the, it also says unmute or mute when you would like to speak. And if you go under reactions, you can click on the raise hand icon that indicates that you would like to make some comments. And if you click on the raise hand icon again, it'll lower your virtual hand. We do have, we actually have our guest speakers for the agenda today. So welcome. And anyone who would like to make any public comments, you can either send me a message on the chat or raise hand at that time when we go to public comment section so that I can put you on the list. Chair Calabia, if you would, I can go ahead and read the agenda before I take roll call of the AAC members. That might give another minute or so for anyone who's still trying to join the meeting.
Good idea. Please.
Okay. Thank you. So we would go through the roll call of the committee members. And afterwards, Chair Calabia would go through the motion of reviewing and approving of the today's meeting agenda with prior meeting minutes. At 4:10, we have Mitch Nietzsche, Ronaldo Grimaldi, and Janet Fikru. They would be presenting elevator and escalator services processes. At 5 p.m., we have Deborah Fisher, one of our AAC members. She would present developmental disabilities. At 5:30 p.m., we have ombudsman report, 5:45 public comment section, and the meeting would adjourn at 6 p.m. At this point, I would go ahead and take the roll call of the AAC members, so please confirm your presence. Elver Ariza Silva. Darnese Bush. Tino Calabia.
Present.
Thank you. Vanessa Coles. Rico Dempsey.
Present.
Thank you. Deborah Fisher. Marcy Goldstein.
Yeah.
Thank you. Melanie Henderson. Steve Caffin.
Present.
Thank you. Thomas sure. Mangrum. Philippa Mazel. Anthony Oberg.
Here.
Thank you. Bill Posner.
Present.
Thank you. Doris Ray. Denise Rush.
Present.
Thank you. Paul Semaford. Patrick Sheehan. And Kelly Simono. Okay, that concludes the roll call for today's meeting.
And this is Vanessa. I am here. I'm on my cell phone. Oh.
Thank you, Vanessa. I'll mark your presence.
Thank you.
So, just a request for our presenters. For your presentation, please describe your presentation in detail for our members who are blind or have low vision, and also for any members of the public who may be blind or may have low vision. And thank you in advance for that. Okay, another comment I would like to add is that all the speakers would have a 3-minute mark. Prior to 3 minutes, I would try to give an alert of 30 seconds ahead of time if possible. I would not want to interrupt, but so I would try to say that at as most appropriate time as I can. But at the 3-minute completion, there will be a sound, which you have heard in past meetings. So just so you know, we are doing this to make sure that everyone who would like to make comments gets an opportunity. If we have time and if you have any additional comments, we would surely come back so that you can share your comments and feedback. At this point, Chair Calabria, I would ask for you to move the meeting forward. You have the floor.
Thank you, Anu. Just one clarification. The 3-minute marker is meant for people who are commenting either from the public or members who are commenting. Presenters such as, for example, Mitch Nietzsche and Rolando Grimaldi and later Deborah Fisher, presenters will have more time than that. They won't be subject to the three minute deadline. In short, though, the agenda is at 4:05, which we're a little behind now. We'll review the prior minutes, but right now we're reviewing the agenda, and at 4:10 we'll have a discussion of elevator and escalator service processes. At 5:00, Deborah Fisher will preview a future program on developmental disabilities. And at 5:30, there'll be an ombudsman report. The public comment period is at 5:45, and we adjourn promptly at 6:00. I should mention too, anyone who saw an original agenda may recall that we were to hear designers who would be designing and working on the 8000 series train. They had been scheduled to work with us during this meeting, but that's been postponed till January. Is there any other suggestions for an agenda item? AAC members, anyone have a suggestion for an additional agenda item? If not, we'll go to the draft minutes, which were reviewed in brief last month. I'm sorry, last meeting in December, and these are the draft minutes of our bus rail subcommittee meeting of November 8th, 2021. And one of the opening points that was made was Dr. Phil Posner, the chair of the overall Accessibility Advisory Committee, recommended that we invite the new board of directors member, Dr. Lowe, to the first December meeting, and that was done. And we were glad she came, and we presented a number of items to her. Back at the draft minutes for November 8th, there was a floating bus stops discussion led off by Matt Johnson, who is manages floating bus stops for Montgomery County. As far as I can tell, he probably has the longest history of involvement with floating bus stops in our region. And he discussed two of the new ones, and I think there are about four, I'm sorry, two of the earlier ones built in 2017 and four of the new ones that were built in 2 years afterwards. Actually, I'm sorry, it was three new or second generation floating bus stops that he referred to. We also heard from, let's see, Jim Homery, who mentioned a regional task force meeting in which a variety of people from around the region were invited to discuss the creation of guidelines and proposals for floating bus stops. We heard also from Hannah Rowe, the senior program manager, regarding the platform improvement program. She updated us on where that stood. We then heard from, Kelly Simino, one of our own members, discussed a experience by someone who uses a powered wheelchair and had difficulty at one of the stations because of the discrepancy between the level of the rail car and the station. We then had Jim Hamry talk about paper signage installation locations. There were a few questions to him about that. And that was that covers the agenda. So having reviewed it at more length last week during the AAC meeting, and again during this, the bus rail subcommittee meeting, do I hear any suggestion for additions that should be made, or may I now take a call for a motion to approve the draft minutes as reviewed last week and this week? Motion to approve, anyone?
I make the motion to approve, Tino.
Thank you, Steve. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Anthony. Having the motion made and seconded, is there approval for the minutes? Is there any disapproval? Hearing no disapproval, the minutes are accepted. Now let's go to the first item on the agenda. And I mentioned that I'm bringing up the agenda at the moment. Mitch Nietzsche and Rolando Grimaldi are going to discuss elevator and escalator service processes. Are you there, Mitch and Rolando?
Yes, good evening, everybody. I brought with us today to present Yannette Fikru, and I would like to introduce her to the committee. Yannette is the project manager for special projects, elevator, escalator, and some of the work she's doing directly impacts the AAC. So she put this together for us. So Yannette, you're up.
And Yannette, again, as much as possible, since we have attendees who are of low vision or blind, please do your best to describe what you show us on the screen. Annette?
Okay.
Mitch, is she here? You're muted, Mitch.
Yeah, let us see.
Yeah. Yannette, are you on?
She was on earlier.
Yes, my
got dropped off.
Good afternoon. Okay, my apologies. As I was sharing, I lost access to my microphone. But good afternoon, everyone. If you'll give me a moment. Good afternoon. I will be sharing my screen shortly. All right, so again, my name is Yannette Fikru, and I'm a project manager in the Office of Elevators and Escalators. And thank you, Mitch, for the introduction. I'm here with Mr. Michnichi and Mr. Grimaldi, which are respectively the General Superintendent and the Assistant General Superintendent of ELIS. And so the mission of our Office of Elevator and Escalator Services is to manage and maintain all vertical transportation equipment within the authority, and we are committed to providing the safest and the most reliable quality service to our customers through the use of technology, training, and education. And by empowering each other, we continuously strive. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, we can hear you clearly. Sorry for interruption, but this is Anu. If you are intending to share your screen,
it's not sharing. All right, my apologies for
it was, but not now.
All right.
Now we see it. Thank you.
Perfect. All right, again, my apologies. All right. So with that being said, all right, is the page changing? Yep, there we go. All right. So for elevators and escalators, one of the most critical performance indicators is, of course, service availability. And what I'm sharing right now is our availability numbers for the fiscal year of 22, which is starting July of 2021 through the November dates. As you could see, for elevators, we are at 97.6% availability for the month of November, and for escalators, we are at 92.4%. Now, keep in mind the total number of elevators that we have on the screen are excluding assets impacted by the station shutdowns, but they do include all units that are out due to capital improvement projects, maintenance, and what have you. So how do we communicate the outages that impact our customers? Our primary source of communication is the WMATA.com surface status page, which has the most up-to-date and current information. And customers are also able to set up an alert system. So if there is an outage at a location that they frequent, then WMATA.com will send out an automatic email notification of any outage. And that is at www.wmata.com under the services subheading, under the elevators and escalators and surface status page. Now, this status is updated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to reflect outages and services and service restoration as reported to the Elevator and Escalator Operations Center by the station manager and the maintenance staff. Now, how that would work is whenever there's an issue that's reported, a work ticket is generated. And what that happens, automatically, WMATA.com information page is updated with information such as the location, the type of asset impacted, whether it's an elevator or escalator, the exact location, and reason for the outage, such as, you know, whether it's out for major repairs or if it's a preventive maintenance inspection going on, if it's a modernization or a service call.
You know, could you mm-hmm. explain where that information appears at the station itself, either above ground or on the mezzanine level or on the station level?
So at the station level, in the station passenger information display system, as well as the kiosk information display system, it will appear there, as well as station PA system will announce of the outages. And of course, in addition to that, there are some, you know, physical signs or barricades.
Janet, one more thing. The information that comes in the station display, it's only related to the elevator outages, not to the escalator outages.
Oh, just for the elevators, okay.
Yes.
I stand corrected. Thank you, Roland. All right, which I guess we'll get to on the next slide. The moment that a work ticket gets created and there's a service outage notified, then the website, of course, which is the primary service of notification, gets updated. And once the issue has been resolved or work has been completed and ticket is closed, then within 5 minutes, that information also relays back into the system, into the WMATA.com. And you will see that a specific location that was mentioned before is gonna be removed. And that's an indicator of the issue being resolved. And that has touched on some of the other elements of how we do communicate our outages at the present location is, of course, using the station passenger information display system and the kiosk information display system, station public address system, as well as physical barrier signs. But here in Ellis, we're continuously thinking about how to improve and provide better service to our customers. So with that being said, we do realize there are about 92% of our escalators and 84% of elevators have the capability to be monitored remotely. And Ellis currently is exploring the use of this tool to enhance the communication and response time related to these outages. So what are the new stuff that we're working on in providing enhanced customer experience? And I will be sharing some of the new feasibility studies that are currently underway. So one of the feasibility study we are looking into is looking into a new digital display or messaging board. Our aim is to communicate the status of elevators in real time to customers. And what you see in the pictures are samples that we're looking through. So we will be able to communicate information such as if the unit is under limited service, we will still be able to provide service, but you know, we ask the customer to press the help signal. So that way that information could be communicated back to the maintenance service worker that's available there to make the unit available right away.
In this case, sorry to interrupt, Janet. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we perform preventive maintenance during revenue hours on some of the elevators. And in that case, that's that's what it would say, limited service, and press help. So if somebody needs the elevator, we'll stop the work and we'll make the elevator available to customer.
All right.
Yanel and Rolando, I am not a user of a wheelchair myself, but I know that wheelchair users have in the past encountered at the station level an elevator that doesn't work, that won't bring them to another level, even if it's only to the station manager's level. What happens when an elevator supposedly serving the station level, the platform level, is broken and someone in a wheelchair cannot use it? What is the scenario to deal with that situation?
Well, in that case, let's see, if there is a couple of scenarios. If it just happened that we're not even notified, so we're not gonna be aware of it. But the scenario is that the station manager should direct the customer to, it may be the nearest station or to a station where they can transfer to get the same service, to get there through either a shuttle bus or something like that. It depends on the location, but that should be the service that should be provided.
I didn't mean to cut you off, I'm sorry, but this is really an attempt to communicate better with our customers. So some of the things you see here that are things in the development that are, this is our lab that you're looking at. And they're even looking at something for the hearing impaired that would work so they could also be messaged if an elevator was out of service. But so this is more messaging. I think currently there's nothing that would change as far as if somebody happened upon an elevator that was inoperative, other than that they would know right away. But everything else would still apply. So if that's what I'm hearing, that I'm trying to answer the question best I could.
Thank you. Go on, Yanel.
All right, thank you. All right, so in terms of existing campaigns that we're working on, I'm going to give you a few updates regarding escalator lighting. I believe in the past, there was an issue that was raised regarding the balustrade lighting on the new escalators, which use cool colors, which is about 6,000 Kelvin bulbs. Now these bulbs produce a bluish white light that aim to mimic daylight, but they may pose hardship on the visually impaired customers. Yes. So one of the mitigating actions that are into place right now is to use light bulbs that are light to warm color bulbs, which is 3,000 Kelvins, for eye safety and best contrast at select locations. So to, you know, our customers could review and provide feedback. Hopefully that's a better lighting system. Right now, there is one completed location, which is the Pentagon City. The two new escalators, which the entrance is right across the mall, they have been outfitted with the new 3,000 Kelvin light bulbs.
And will all of the stations be outfitted with 3,000 Kelvin light bulbs?
So provided that we are code compliant, again, some of the considerations is we need to receive jurisdictional approval. And that depends on the ambient lighting condition, which dictates the bulb light. It must be a minimum of a 5-foot candle level. So when we do inspections, if the lighting overall is within 5-foot candles, then yes, they will allow us. I would gather there will be some locations that may not pass code, so we won't be able to have this, but I would imagine the majority going forward will be able to take this action.
Thank you.
And the next upcoming location that we're going to have this on is at the Glenmont escalator, the south side of the Georgia Avenue. And all right, so this is the escalator. I just mentioned that Pendleton City, which is now open. So we invite you to please, you know, check out this location and provide any feedback. And we welcome your input. And of course, if this is the way to go, then going forward, then all the new capital improvement projects will have the 3K lights instead of the 6,000 Kelvins.
You know, is this picture showing us what it looks in real life that bright?
Yes, this picture was recently taken, a couple of days ago.
And any other stations like this?
Right now, this was the first station of its kind that we're trying out this light bulb at. Again, that's why we're inviting you to provide some feedback.
Sure, we have some low vision members, as well as at least one guest who has helped us discuss and fix some of the problems that arise from such lighting. And by that, I mean, as a guest, Barbara, who I know is on the program with us. But go ahead, Yanel.
Yes. So, you know, please go and check it out and see how you feel. And if, you know, the 3,000 Kelvin light is helping, or if we need to go in another direction. But this was one of the locations we're piloting out with Glenmont. That's going to be upcoming next. And hopefully we will provide a better status update as to when the Glenmont location will be completed.
Yes.
I believe Virginia Center is also being outfitted with these lights as they're being integrated into the new escalators being installed now.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. All right, and speaking of capital improvement initiatives, projects, there is a procurement process that's underway for the next elevator rehabilitation, which is set to rehabilitate approximately 103 elevators in the system. So currently we're looking at a possible contract award by early summer of this year. The project would start date of late spring of 2022. All right, and that is all I have to present. Thank you for the time.
Well, thank you. Stay with us, Yanette. Members, and I know some of you are present who are low vision or blind. First of all, do you have any reactions to what we've seen? Any questions?
Chair Calabia, Steve has his hand up. Steve, go ahead.
Okay. I think Barbara came before me. Barbara?
Hey there. This is Barbara. And I really want to thank you guys. I go to Pentagon City a lot. And in all my excitement to get my shopping done, I went right past the escalator that had reopened early, at least 3 weeks early. So I was, a little disappointed in myself for missing that thing, but obviously I have low vision, so I will just use that as my reason for now. But that was really, really great. I rode on it on the way back, in other words, going down. It really looks good. I think you could, if you want to go up to 4,000K, and in terms of the illumination, I believe that 5-foot candles is a bit low. I was wondering if you had other options that you could share with us. Another thing is, gosh, I've been going through that station a lot when I got to find the elevator, and I know where it is by that brand new Chick-fil-A. And I was like thinking, gosh, what happens if I can't find that elevator? And then I have to go all the way over to the mall. And I'm not familiar with that route because I'm spoiled, I guess, that my normal elevator and escalator has been working, but I would really like to know the process for me finding that way. I didn't see any signs. I did see a lot of signs on the part that you guys barricaded off. Signs were really great. They were at eye level, so I could see them in the dark. And so that was nice to know, hey, how long it was going to be out of service and that kind of thing. But I don't know. Maybe I just missed it, that I didn't see any signs giving directions to the other escalator or elevator. So yeah, I'm on top of this, and it's really good news. So thank you.
Awesome, thanks.
Mitch?
Yep.
Did you have a response to Barbara?
No, it's I was enjoying the feedback. As far as a wayfinding is concerned, Rolando, maybe you can chime in here, but I believe the standard wayfinding should be back in place now. So I wasn't sure if you were talking, Barbara, about the standard wayfinding that is normally there or signs that to indicate the duration of the construction.
I was referring to how to get to the escalator, the farther escalator, you know, the one that wasn't out of service, and that would be during the construction time and also outside of the construction time.
Yes, Barbara. So I normally it's our the main WMATA office with our capital improvement people that they put the signage in there. I'm not sure what type of sign they have there, but there is the one going now on the opposite side. So I'm going to make sure that we check the sign on the other side and make sure that they have signage directing you to the escalator that they are now open on this side and also for the elevator. So I didn't know what they had previously, but we will check the current situation and make sure that that information is provided on the barricades. As far as the five-foot candles, that's the minimum lighting required, and we have way more than that. So the five-foot candle, it's really the minimum that it's required by codes, and we do have more than that available.
Oh, do you know how much it is about?
Well, the five-foot candle is the minimum required within any space within the escalator. I believe the way I saw it right now, I think we have easily between 10 and...
Sorry, Rolando, it was seven. The inspection report was 17.5.
Okay, thank you, Mitch.
What, foot candles?
Correct.
You could go a little higher, not to be greedy, but we got a whole lot of different wide spectrum of people who can see. Some need a lot light, some need not so much. But I do think being at that one, is going to the outside, nothing else is going to be helping to add light, ambient light. Mm-hmm. So if you're riding in the dark, that would be an issue. In the daytime, of course, not so much.
So we do, I guess we got to try to find that happy medium, and that's why we appreciate the feedback. And I just want to give a quick note that a lot of this legwork with signs and making sure we we have wayfinding up and these customer service things are Rolando and his crew, and they do all this legwork to go behind the constructors and the teams to do all that. So he's listening to you, and we take notes during these meetings, and we're trying to improve. So I just wanted to say thank you to Rolando and his team for doing all that.
Oh, no, no. It looks awesome. I these are just minor tweaks. So
right. Keep
up the great work.
Thank you, Barbara. And we heard you say, let's go up to 4,000. And I think on the next upcoming one, we will try the 4,000. And like Mitch said, we just need to find the right balance that can satisfy everybody.
Is that the next station you're referring to?
Yeah, so during this capital improvement that we're replacing escalator, we can try to have the next one provided with the 4,000 one, so we can get feedback and try to see which one will fit better, and then we're just gonna go in that direction. And
so, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I'm sorry, this is just so exciting to me that I brought it in on you.
Steve?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
All right. I'm gonna cluster a couple of questions just for the sake of expediency. But one thing I want to say, you know how much farther ahead you are than some other cities. A couple of days ago, I saw in the newspaper New York City announced that they were going to be putting elevators in 25 stations, which shows how behind they are in relation to the work that you're doing. So congratulations. Some questions. The screens that provide the elevator outage information run through many iterations just because of the extensive nature of the information. During that time, next train information stops, particularly at the screens near the entrances. And that often results in a rush of passengers who don't know when the trains are coming, and so they err on the side of they're coming immediately. My question is, and I have another question after this, is there any way that that information can perhaps be separated from the next train information so that both needs can be handled? And that's one question. The second one is there a policy that if one escalator is out, the up escalator becomes the primary escalator, or is it up to the station manager? For the most part, it's done, but I've seen occasions where the wrong escalator was the one being used, and so that's my second question. Thank you.
So working backwards, I would say you are correct. Rail transportation sets configuration and we support it. But yes, I believe they're better equipped to handle the question, but yes, that is what is supposed to happen. And that's from a safety perspective, because if there is an issue, egress is the most important thing that we can get our customers out faster.
Is it a policy or is it station manager's prerogative?
No, I believe it's built into their work instruction. I'm not quite sure if it's a policy, but I believe it's one of their work instructions. They're better equipped to answer that. But yes, you are correct. That is what should be happening. Your first question to go back. So. Carol may be able to shed a little more light on this, but I do know the authority is looking to go to digital messaging in the future and screens to communicate better. But, you know, as far as messaging, these messages that you saw are some things we're experimenting to communicate with our customers, and that is kind of what we will have control over. Until this larger project takes effect. So I hate to punt in this question. For that question, I really can't answer it because we don't have any control over that.
Mitch, I'd like to add a few things in reference to that project. If you could go back to the slide where you show the limited service. Okay. I wanted to let the advisory committee know that when Mitch and his team attend these meetings, they do listen to you, and they listen to you very carefully. Mitch and his team came up with this feasibility study to provide signage that tells you this elevator is out of service. What limited service means is that we're working on the elevator right now for maintenance, but if you need to use the elevator, just let us know, press help, and we'll activate the elevator. You can get out of the station or you can go in, okay? So that was one of his team's efforts to address the things that you have been talking about in these meetings. And of course, these signs are extremely large, so they would take up a lot of space in our in limited space that we have for signage in some of our stations, et cetera. So there's been a lot of discussion on how this should be modified, et cetera. But I want you to know that they're working on it. They're working on addressing all these issues to make it more seamless to use our system. The signage that is being provided now in our stations are these screens, these large screens that have our maps on them. Some of them are going to be able to be activated to tell you more about what's going on in our station. We're not there yet, but they're able to do that. So that's something that Mitch may be talking about. They're at all the platforms. The new platforms, we're installing those type of screens that are going to be able to be interactive. And our office is also advocating for messaging and audio messaging to describe those pieces of information that somebody who's blind may require. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Carol. Thank you.
Members or guests, any other questions or comments?
Yeah, Claudia, this is Venu. I do not see any.
I wave my hand.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to say it's for the lying. I'm not visually impaired, but I feel safer on the platform when the lighting is brighter, especially in the evening. I don't know why, but I think the lighting that's brighter deters people to commit crime. That's all I have to say. So any bright lights for it?
Well, hopefully the 3K isn't dim either. I think it's fine. I agree with you, but I think we got to try to find that happy medium that
right,
works for everybody. That's what we're trying to do.
Well, yeah, in reference to lighting, I think there's some stations, for example, in interior stations, if they bring up the light right in front of the elevator, which is easier to do, much, much brighter than the rest of the place, someone who has low vision, and actually people who don't, might end up feeling a little bit worse when they're outside of that spotlight and then not be able to see because your eyes don't adjust very fast. So what Mitch was saying about the happy medium is very important.
Any other comments?
Just to say this light, the lighting at the entrances and exits to the stations is also a safety issue where I think lighting lighting eliminates the, let's say, the accumulation of just people hanging out at the entrances. And it feels safer when you're exiting a station that's lit on the outside, especially in the evening and late at night when, when things are very solitary. So thank you.
I'm going to add that when the stations began opening up in 1976, I was struck by how dim the lighting was in the first stations. And I gather it was because Harry Weiss, the designer of the first stations, was trying to play up the light and shadow effect of his brutalist design, the waffle-like rotunda ceiling, would show up better, presumably, would show up aesthetically better with low light that originally was in the stations. Obviously, that was a problem, and it's been much corrected over the decades. And so it's very different now in terms of lighting from what Harry Weiss's original vision was looking for. Any other questions?
Chair Kaladia, this is, I know I do not see any other hands up at this point.
Okay. Well, I have, it's 4:52. We have a few more minutes. I'd be curious, Mitch or Rolando or Yannette, your comments on the broad history of lighting within the stations from 1976 to current decades.
Well, I can tell you from my perspective, increased lighting is just so much better for I think for everybody. I can remember when I first came to the authority, it was 1993, and that there's a vast improvement in the lighting. But I'll kick that one to Rolando. He probably spends more time in the system than I do now.
Thank you, Mitch. Yes. So I've been with the authority for a little bit above 11 years, and I've seen many changes in 11 years. There has been some lighting project that they were going on around 5-6 years ago in some of the downtown station. And there is lighting works that gets done on all those platform rehabilitation that started 2 years ago on the Virginia side. And then on the E line, and then the next one on the D line. So lighting is very important, and WMATA as an authority knows that, and there is many projects going on in trying to improve lights. Carol works very hard on all those projects. She's always been there advocating for everybody at WMATA to do the right thing, and I believe we are going into the right direction, and I've seen great improvement in the last, I would say, 6 years.
It's certainly different from 1976.
Yes, definitely. Like I said, I think I've been here for a little bit above 15 years, but in the system for 12 years, and I've seen many, many improvement in those 12 years.
Thank you. It is now 4:54. Any last comments from our presenters or?
Chair Kaladia, this is Anu. Debbie Fisher just put her hand up. Debbie, if you have a question or comment, go ahead.
Thank you. I meant to ask this question of you before. What is the procedure if a person in a wheelchair is riding an elevator and it gets stuck? Are you able to, how do you ensure that they're safely able to?
In most cases, most of the elevators have cameras in them, at least the street elevators. Well, a good majority have them. So one of the tasks that the operations center have is anybody who gets stuck in an elevator is there to go to that camera, and they also have the ability to call into the elevator. And the idea is let's make sure everybody's safe, keep everybody calm, because the best way to get anybody out of an entrapped elevator is having the elevator safely move it to the next floor. It's not to try to extract passengers. That really should only be done as a very last resort. And, you know, unfortunately, when it happens, you are safe in an elevator. Even if it's stuck, you're safe. There's mechanisms. They cannot fall. But I know that's a hassle, especially when you're trying to get somewhere. But if you're stuck, it's best to just wait for the technician to arrive. And sometimes it's Rolando himself. So that's really the best way to do it.
Yes, and let me add a few more things in this regard. So the best practice and the only practice, unless it's really impossible to move the elevator, is to bring the elevator to a floor level and let the customer out, for any type of customers. Sometimes fire department is on the scene, and fire department, if they get there before us, they don't want to listen, and they take things in their hand. And unfortunately, there is nothing that we can do in those occasions. But the majority of the fire department group, they listen to us. If we arrive on the scene and we'll tell them, let me look at it and try to see if I can put the elevator back in service, they will wait before taking any action. If we are able to move the elevator back to a safe location and extract the customer. So that's definitely it's the best way to do it, and that's the way that we are trying to do, and I believe majority of the time we are able to do that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions from members or members of the public? If not, we're close to the end of this agenda item, and I want to thank Jeanette, Mitch, and Rolando for coming and describing and answering questions that we put to you.
Great. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having us, and thank you again for all the feedback. Without any of those feedback and Carol working with us, we couldn't make those improvements.
Yes, and I'm sure Barbara will go visit Pentagon City again and report back on what it looks like at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. And thank you all. Our next item is to hear a kind of preview of a developmental disabilities program that Deborah Fisher has kindly agreed to put on for us probably early in 2022. Deborah, do you want to make your statement now as a preview of the program?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And thank you, Tina, for inviting me to do this. And actually, what would be helpful would be if any of you have any particular questions for me to address, particularly when I do the full presentation. I'd love to use this time to collect some of those items. Let me just start by saying that the last almost 2 years, this whole pandemic has not just moved a large fraction of the people with intellectual and developmental disabilities out of transit in general, and the community in particular, but it's also coincided with some pretty important changes to the way the CMS is funding home and community-based services, which is the long-term care funding source for most of the folks with developmental disabilities. And the reason that matters is because in 2014, when the settings rule, home and community-based service settings rules were changed, the movement was to get people not just increasingly in the community, but to reduce and eliminate to the extent possible any segregation. And because of that, there was initially a big tug of war over the legitimacy of that request. And at this point, any service provider or family member who seeks that kind of service setting for their loved one has to go jump through a bunch of hoops to essentially waive the requirement for integrated services, which means that not only as this pandemic is beginning to come to an end, are people beginning to move into the community as they would have anyway. In fact, the providers are working that much harder to meet the state and federal requirements to have people fully integrated, which means that transportation along with housing and meaningful day or employment has become pretty critical. And so the role of transportation services, both fixed and paratransit, I think are pretty important. That being said, I'm still aware of providers who are out there purchasing vehicles and using the 5310 programs to do so, which kind of flies in the face of integrated services. And they're under a lot of pressure from family members, especially older family members, who basically see the community as a threat. Their loved ones are very vulnerable. Their judgment may be poor, their ability to navigate complex situations and circumstances is limited, and family members are frightened. Now, as Mr. Blake can tell you, we have family members who want paratransit because they think it's safer, and we have family members who don't want paratransit because they think it's not safe. And some of the, again, older families have all the memories of the various paratransit drivers who were engaged in all kinds of inappropriate and downright criminal activities and behavior towards their customers. And so it's hard for some of those family members to put those in the rear mirror and move on. I think younger families are a little more open to it. And so what it leaves us with, I think, today is an understanding that for folks with developmental disabilities, you have to think of transportation needs actually across the spectrum. In my own personal opinion, there's actually a very small percentage who need paratransit. Those people who need supervision can ride public transportation, fixed route, using with their caregiver or their support giver or a direct support professional. So that in fact, that group who might think they need to be automatically in using paratransit for purposes of their safety probably don't. And I have seen many, many people successfully navigate the fixed route systems when they have a one-to-one caregiver. And in some cases, if it's one support professional with two folks. The group for whom paratransit is essential are those with a variety of significant vulnerabilities, medical, physical, and neurosensory. And so there are folks with autism, for example, who will find the fixed routes and the bus and rail just too overstimulating. On the other hand, I love to tell the story of a young man who was in a transition program that I had developed, who went through the year and we had travel trained him and the whole thing. And he got a fabulous job working at the local skilled nursing facility because he was very adept at handling files. He lived out in Damascus, I think, and to get to a bus stop, his family had to drive him. Long story short, he turned down the job offer from the skilled nursing facility because it wasn't far enough away. And his definition of a good job required a good long commute. And so he ended up taking a job downtown, which meant his parents got him to the bus stop. The bus took him to the subway. The subway took him downtown. And then he had, I don't know, a 15-minute walk. It was an hour and a half each way. And that was his definition of a good job. So understanding that the needs are truly different and there really is just a small group of people who absolutely need paratransit. But parental fear is often the biggest barrier, and it's the place where we need to do the most work. And it's why some of you may remember that I had mentioned, I don't know, a couple meetings ago at an AAC meeting that travel training is too late in the sequence of preparation for helping people access and use the fixed route systems, because the family members are so frightened at their loved one's exposure to the public, and they see the public as threatening. And even when we have spent time with them and said, the public are your eyes and ears, they're actually the safest place. And, you know, in a taxi or even in a metro, any kind of small bus system, you have fewer eyes and fewer integrated eyes keeping an eye out for folks. So that's the biggest barrier, that metro access, despite the fact that the drivers, for the most part, do a fantastic job for some parents. Their safety in small groups. For others, there's the threat. And that's really what we come up against all the time. And the families who come to understand the value of their loved ones using bus and rail are also able to support their loved ones when they get lost or when they miss a station or when they get off on the wrong side of the track. And, you know, all of these things requires parental training, but it also requires staff training. And you often end up with these alliances between staff and parents because the staff is feeling a responsibility to make sure the child, and these are adults often, but young children too, high school age, and they're afraid. And so they end up inadvertently or deliberately reinforcing the fears. There are some models of starting travel training early for all folks with disabilities, for folks who in the schools have individualized education plans. So there, it's possible, and I think it's why we have more younger families where there's a certain amount of comfort. But nonetheless, it's their biggest challenge. And I'll spend more time and happy to spend more time talking about that and exploring ways that we're trying to address it.
To that end, Deborah, at bottom, this is a kind of bread and butter issue for WMATA. The fewer people who rely on paratransit and move over to bus and rail, the regular transit, the cheaper it becomes to get some of these new customers to where they need to go, as opposed to having them rely on paratransit as in the past. So it's an important bread and butter issue. Is it possible, though, for perhaps the program to involve maybe a 2 or 3 person panel, perhaps a parent that has learned how less threatening it is than once it was to them for their child? Is it possible to get an adult who's one of the people with developmental disabilities to join in the discussion? Is it possible to get one of the agencies to agencies that have experienced this and have tried to work to the same goal that you're talking about? Is it possible to get a panel like that together, 2 or 3 people, to talk to us about it?
Absolutely. That should not be difficult. I know some people that I can easily call on to see if they would be comfortable doing it. And if not, I'll talk with a couple of providers. I can think right off the bat, I can think of both a provider, a parent, and a person who relies on bus and rail. I mean, we could bring in somebody who relies on Metro Access, but I don't actually think we need to do that. That's always the default. And I know that I know that there's no real need to do that.
Sure. You know, when I first looked into this, having heard you as a new member here, I was astounded to see the CDC statistics on how large the population is, how large in comparison with other members of the disability community. I think I shared with you the CDC chart. If something like that could be shown too, I think for me as well as for our other members, it might be an eye-opener as to the scale of the population out there that we should be encouraging to take public transit rather than Metro Access.
Well, actually, what's interesting about all those demographics is that I can guarantee you that those are underestimates. Wow. Because there are so many different ways of defining a developmental disability. But the truth is, if we were really to count all those young people, all those people who had IEPs going through school, who had ADD and learning disabilities, who don't actually access services as adults with developmental disabilities. If you look at the chronically mentally ill population, there are an enormous number of those people who are actually folks with developmental disabilities, but because of comorbid behavioral health issues that evolve, they present, or the system puts them into a behavioral health category rather than a developmental disability category. My guess is that the numbers are much higher than we realize.
Well, just to start off with, though, to get official statistics that are out there from the federal government, like the CDC, even if that's a minimum or a low estimate, I found that sure. really eye-opening how many that the government counts.
Right.
And I take your word for it that the government is undercounted. This, for one reason or another, it's hard to deal with this statistics. But just to see the official statistics was for me an eye-opener.
Yeah.
Do any other members of the advisory committee have suggestions on what they would like to see and the kind of panel or the kind of program that we can all learn from that Debbie has agreed to put on? Other members? I thought I saw that Dr. B was in the audience. Dr. B, are you still there? I guess not.
I am. Hi, everyone. How's everyone doing today?
Okay, how are you, Dr. B?
I'm fantastic. I've been following, and thank you, Ms. Fisher, for bringing such an important topic. This topic is one that the travel training side of the Elledge office works with closely as we're in the school system. And so some of the same concerns and things that she brought up, we definitely have heard before and familiar with.
Okay. Well, in any event, Debbie, if perhaps in February or March, in January, yep. we're going to be hearing from about the Series 8000 trains that are being worked on by WMATA staff as well as Hitachi designers. We're going to be hearing from them and presenting the ideas that we've worked on for many years. February or March, perhaps you can have something put together for us.
I'll be happy to.
Great.
That gives me plenty of time. So thank you.
Yes. Let's see. I don't have the agenda in front of me. Where are we now, Anu?
Chair Calabia, this is Anu. The next topic is ombudsman report.
Oh, yes. And do we have a new ombudsman? Are we to be introduced to a new ombudsman?
We do not. Carol is going to be...
I'll be your ombudsman for tonight. Yeah. Okay. All right. I will be addressing an issue that was brought up by a member of the committee in reference to gaps between the platform and the train at Crystal City Station and Grosvenor Station. And we went out to David Wall, who may be on the meeting as well, and myself went out and verified what the gaps were like at those stations. And they are at Crystal City, closer to the elevator. The gap, the vertical gap is 1.5 inches to the gap reducer and 2.5, and the horizontal gap is 2.5 inches from the platform. And these are the worst case in the station. Other gaps are smaller. Those still are within the ADA standards. They're still compliant. But because it was brought up as an issue, we're going to bring it up to track and structures to see if there's a way to mitigate, maybe lower the track a little bit so the train could be more at level with the platform at those areas of the station. But this is not going to be a quick turnaround. I just want to let you know. There are areas at the station that are more level. that are not, unfortunately, the areas that have the biggest vertical gaps are closer to the elevators. Now, at Grosvenor Station, the worst vertical gap was 1 inch, and that's half an inch less than the maximum allowed by the ADA. And the worst horizontal gap was 3 inches, which is exactly how much the ADA allows you as a maximum. So both stations are not ideal. You know, we really try to do better than what the ADA requires in all stations. But these two older stations have that condition.
You know, Carol, in my neighborhood, there are two older high schoolers who use wheelchairs. Mm-hmm. And I happened to see them, and I started chatting with them. And one of them said that the front rollers, I don't know the terminology for the equipment, but the two front wheels are very small.
Yes.
And hers is not the only wheelchair that has these very small front wheels. And she told me that she has to wait for a train that will accommodate her small front wheels, because a lot of them don't. Are you familiar with this kind of problem?
Has to wait for a train? I mean, all the trains are going to do that.
That's what she told me. I should have.
Okay, so this is what happens, and that also includes, that is also something that travel training could help. And actually, there should be training at rehab centers, et cetera, how to do. A lot of people who use wheelchairs, I don't know if you know that I used to work for the Paralyzed Veterans of America. So my knowledge of wheelchair accessibility is tremendously higher than other disabilities. And a lot of people wheel in backwards because the wheel is, the back wheels are larger. There are lots of ways of doing it. I think that there are some trains that come a little bit lower, but at the old stations, that shouldn't be a problem at all. We're working for the 8,000 series cars. We're going to work with them. We've brought it up, and we've had meetings that there may be a better way of transitioning. But what we have done from ADAP perspective to actually fix the gap issue, we have advocated for a change in our standards. So whenever they put a new station or rehab the station, they move the rail closer to the platform, so the gap will be reduced horizontally. And then we also established an ideal gap at ideal height, so that the vertical gap is also works for all our trains.
Right. But, well, since this high schooler lives in my neighborhood, I might be able to find her again.
Yeah.
And ask her if she could explain it, because I'm sure what she told me was that for some trains, the front rollers wouldn't work, but she could wait, and for another train, it would work. I'm not sure how that comes about, but I'll ask her, and maybe she can explain it to us.
Ask them if it's old trains versus new 7,000 series trains.
Okay, would you think that the 7,000 series would be a better fit for...
What station are you dealing with?
Well, she lives in my neighborhood, so it would be Friendship Heights. I didn't ask her which station.
Okay, so that's an old station. Oh. All right.
Yeah.
So...
But I'll try and track her down, and maybe she can explain more in detail.
That would be great. Okay. Because we're trying to improve everything. There's so many variables that don't allow us to do everything at the same time, but we're really working on it, and all that feedback really helps us make decisions, the right decisions on what we're doing.
Sure. Yeah.
There's another issue.
Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead. So you were saying, Tino?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so another issue that was brought up had to do with someone who uses a mobility device getting stuck in a train having to wait for help while everybody else evacuates. And
Kelly.
So I guess, is she on today?
I didn't see her.
She's in. Okay. She's I don't think so. Okay. So the procedure when you're stuck in a train, whether you use a wheelchair, whatever anxiety you have, if you see some troublemaker in the train and you don't feel safe or something, you can always press the button, call the operator and let them know you're there. And that's the procedure. So if you use a wheelchair and the train is stuck, you press the button and you tell the operator, I use a wheelchair, I cannot self-evacuate, I'm on this train, and you give them the train number. It's on the end doors of our trains. It's very well labeled. And they will tell you, well, we're going to be there in 15 minutes, or we can't get there until 30 minutes. But that's the procedure, so that you don't have the anxiety of having to wait just for them to show up. You have to let them know you're there so that you're sure that they know you're there. The same thing happens in building evacuations, for example. You have an area of refuge. You let people know you're there, and then they come and evacuate you. You're in a safe area, and they evacuate you. So there's no magic number. There's no magic way of doing this. It has to be a communication. If you can't reach a train operator, you call 202-962-2121. That's our police department, our transit police department. And you let them know you're stuck in a train and this is happening, and they will respond to you. Okay.
You know,
so those were the two issues that were brought up.
Right. In regards to the last example you gave, it's possible, unfortunately, that someone who's being pestered or perhaps, a victim of sexual exposure or something of that sort, if they were to go and try and press the button, that person may take it out on them before they can get to the button. So let
me give you an example of, I think it's just a matter of thinking. You just get off at the next stop. As soon as you get off the train, there are other people, you're in camera views, and then the station, you have to get help from the station manager. It happens to everyone. I need to tell you a little story. I know that we have time, so I'll just tell you a little story about what happened to me on a train. I am extremely allergic to bee stings. I was actually stung about 10 years ago, and I ended up in the emergency room, and they had to give me tons of stuff, and they told me there are millions, it's a million to one or whatever. So anyway, so I stay away from bees. But one day I get in the train and I find a bee on my shoulder.
Whoa.
Okay, so I tell the woman next to me, I said, I am extremely allergic to bees. If I get stung, I'm gonna need your help. I have an EpiPen in my purse and you need to call 911. And that's what I said, because I didn't remember the Metro Transit police number. So I told her that. And she says, the next stop, just get up and take off your coat and run out of the train. And I did that. And you should see how many people came to my rescue. They all came and tried to hold the bee back in the train that I could escape. So, and that's when I realized, I wish I knew I had been using social media to thank those women that saved me from the bee. But yes, there are so many people in our stations. You know what Deborah said? it's safer when other people are watching you. So I always try to ride on the first train when I'm going places that are going to, there's not that many, there are not that many people in the train are at an odd hour, because I know the station, that the operator is right there. So if something happens, I don't even need to press the button. I get out of the train and yell and let them know. So there are lots of things that one must do when we do public transportation, but that's.
Okay, two things, Carol. Mm-hmm. My wife is also allergic to bees, and she has to carry an epidural needle. The second thing is what you told me and what you told us is another reason to consider having open gangways trains, because open gangways trains allows one person to move from one train to the next train to the next train to the next train. Or if they don't do it, they can be seen from other trains. So the safety factor is another reason to consider open gangways trains. In any event, with respect to what we've just talked about, I will try and find the high schooler who has this wheelchair with smaller wheels in the front. And she can explain why it is that she can wait for a train that'll accept her, as opposed to the train that went by that she had to leave because that train didn't have the kind of clearance she needed. It is now 5:32, and we're on the ombudsman report. As I mentioned before, we don't obviously have a new ombudsman yet. What's in the works? David's been going now for some time.
We're in the process. And we don't have an ombudsman yet. We're working on it.
Okay. The other thing that I would mention is that you said you worked for a veterans.
The Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Which reminds me that we lost one of our great heroes, Senator Dole, and. I must admit, when I shared the photo of Senator Dole sitting quietly in the Senate chamber as they were deliberating on certifying the Convention of the United Nations, which had adopted the basic kind of approach to working with people with disabilities that we do in the U.S. And he sat there and they went through it, and five votes more were needed and five votes never came. I don't think that they would come even if we brought it up this year or next year. On the other hand, the senator is gone and he was one of our heroes, and I learned a lot from the people who responded to the CNN shot that I shared with people showing the senator on that terrible day. Well, it is now 5:34, and the next item was public comment period. Wait, I see two people with hands up, and I don't know who is first, but Doris Ray and Steve.
I think Doris was before me.
Yes, Doris. And thank you, Doris, for your comments on that terrible day in the Senate when this,
this
Senate
Doris.
Failed to certify the convention.
And I would have had a comment earlier on the earlier topic, except that I had to come in the middle because of something that I was doing for work, so I was late to the meeting. But anyway, I wanted to ask Carol about the GAP stuff, because I was wondering if the Transportation Research Board or any similar entity or DOT itself has looked at the idea of potentially redesigning the trains so that it would be the train itself that could minimize the gap. What I mean by that is I know that early on, even before the ADA, for buses and actually specifically trams that were operating in cities like Denver, they had a German brand, I think a Grumman train that had a, not train, but whatever trams are called, that had ramps that, like our low floor ramps, come out and minimize the gap between the island that there in Denver, where you got the bus platform. So, so I'm wondering whether that has ever been looked at as a possibility, so that in older stations you wouldn't have to do a big reconstruction to minimize the gap.
Doris, that is something that can be done in slower trains, because we have a rapid train system, and you know, the, by the time the ramp deploys and retracts and doesn't catch somebody's toes while they're doing it, it's a very difficult thing. We don't have, our gaps are actually fairly small in comparison to systems that have, that deploy those sort of ramps. And I don't think that we have considered something that actually moves from the train. We have changed the, move the rail closer every time we rehabilitate. We can adjust certain things. But I don't think that WMATA has considered that very heavily because of all the issues about when something deploys, you know, it has to be free if there's a foot or if there's a thing. And there's always a, whenever you provide a moving mechanical part on top of another moving mechanical part, it's more of a liability.
Yeah, no, I wasn't actually thinking that WMATA would do it alone. I was just thinking that maybe there was an effort. I wondered whether there was any effort at the national or even international level to look at the designs of the trains themselves.
There are many studies. There are many studies.
Ah.
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to comment on is getting stuck in the trains. And you were mentioning using the intercom. Thank goodness I have never had except one incident where I got stuck in a train at Vienna Station and didn't realize it for whatever reason. And the train doors closed. And we were headed for the end of the, you know, where the train turns around, or the maintenance area beyond the station itself. Anyway, that train started traveling, and I was just petrified. And frankly, I, for all the time I've used the train, I have no idea where their phones are. And I was sitting here thinking about it. And I was thinking to myself, shouldn't we have an occasional announcement on the trains about where those phones are? Because, I have to worry about, particularly between age and also vision impaired, I have to worry about getting myself to the train door in time that I have enough time to get on the doors when they, you know, get okay. in the doors when they open and stuff. So I'm not going to be thinking about being at one particular area on the platform.
Doris, just to so for your personal sake, in the 7000 series cars, you can find the phone call buttons next to the doors at the ends of each car, and also next to the central door. So all doors have those buttons in the 7000 series cars.
All doors,
but in the center doors, they're behind the the seats that are parallel with the track. You know, the
yeah,
priority
like
seats.
Lot,
yeah,
yeah,
no they're
idea.
Right there. And then on the other, the older trains, they only have them at the ends of the cars. So you would have to go towards the ends of both ends of the cars. Next to the door, there's a call button.
Yeah, but you know, the anxiety that people feel when something, and I was certainly anxious. I think I even used my cellular phone or something. I'm not sure anyway. The train finally went back in the other direction. I think it actually reversed.
Yes. At Vienna, the trains go, since it's the end of the line station, they go in and then they go back out in the same track. They reverse.
But just some kind of announcement that reminds people.
About the exit. All right.
Yeah, about the intercoms.
Okay, intercoms.
Carol, the other problem with the intercoms are the instructions are very confusing on various cars as to whether you push the button once or whether you hold the button down. And we have been trying to get the signage fixed for a long time. They have finally fixed them on the 7000 cars,
mm-hmm.
But on the earlier models, it's still a problem because people routinely think you push the button to talk and release the button to not talk, to listen. And on the different years, they're different. And the instructions in the safety instructions and on the phones themselves are very confusing for passengers.
Okay. So we will check on the consistency of what you're supposed to do with the buttons. I don't recall the difference right now. And perhaps have somebody discuss that with us in a future meeting.
Yeah, the 7000s are good, but since we're now using the 6000s and the 2000s and the 3000s, it'd be good for them to get fixed.
Well, I think we're going to get those 7000 back
soon. One day.
Soon.
Now, they're shooting, according to the last board meeting, they said February. Maybe.
Steve, you had your hand up?
Uh-huh, yes. It was to comment on what Carol was talking about with respect to the gangway cars. That was my principal concern about gangway cars, Carol, that especially in late hours and during periods where the trains are not very occupied, there's a vulnerability, particularly in certain, you know, as you're riding the trains, with the gangways open, with the cars open. I felt that in gangway car situations that I've ridden late at night in other systems. And so, I wanted to, that was my principal concern about gangway cars. However, there's also the opposite side, that there's a protection that you have because everybody has visibility as to what may be going on. I think the ideal approach, if it's feasible, might be to have the first car or two not gangway, And that's more of a protective car, particularly in the evening and after hours, and leaving the other cars gangways. I want to tell you that the Moscow subway system uses gangway cars, but they do every two cars being gangway cars. But, you know, I think maybe what we need is a hybrid where there is a feeling of protection, especially during, you know, after hours in the first car or two, as well as gangway cars for the rest of the train. And so that I just wanted to comment on what Carol said. Carol, I'm sensitive to what you were talking about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anu, are any other hands up, Anu?
Yes, I see Ms. Rush has her hand up. Ms. Rush, please unmute yourself and make your comment.
This is Denise Rush. We have not talked about the violence on the rail system, and it's been a great concern for everybody. And I don't know what we can do about it, but we haven't, as the bus rail committee, talked about it. The stabbings, the shootings, the shooting at the train, the fightings, it's you're afraid to get on a train. And that's day or night.
Yes. In fact, I think in one of the bigger cities, maybe with Chicago, there was yesterday a big demonstration by conductors or operators of vehicles to get the attention of the officials to help protect these operators from the kind of violence they've encountered. And that's been especially true during the pandemic. Perhaps we could schedule some sort of presentation from our security office on what's being done to protect not just riders, but also riders and bus operators, conductors of trains. Let's think about that. There are still some hands up. Phil, I see your hand up.
Yes. Ms. Rush has made her comment. Dr. Posner and Barbara both have.
Yes, along with Denise, I would point out that WMATA tried to do something such as removing felons from having access to WMATA. And there was an outcry from some college students and the RAC saying, how can you deny felons and sex offenders access to WMATA? And so the board backed off. So perhaps our group might want to give some other opinions. They were talking about civil rights, and the initial proposal was people arrested for violent or sexual offenses would not be permitted on Metro. And the complaint was they weren't being given due process because they hadn't been convicted yet. They had been arrested. They had been stopped, but they hadn't gotten their trial. So they wanted to continue to permit them to use the rail. And that's an issue that I think needs further discussion. And we might choose to bring that up.
Yes.
I'd also like to mention in my 2 minutes that the budget is coming up in January. And at the last board meeting last Thursday, they did vote to add to the docket for discussion, maintaining the current proposals of the GM to maintain the flat fares on the weekend. But they have not included any of the things we had requested for Metro access. And so we need to be aware, come January, that there will be online surveys, there will be in-person surveys, and there will be hearings. And we if we want those things to happen, including good bus service, metro access service, et cetera, we need to get our friends, our family, and ourselves to every opportunity to participate and give them the information.
Bill, at the first AAC meeting in January, can we have a position paper to share with the members and that they could share with their families and friends?
I will be giving everybody an update at every meeting. And we will have a discussion at every meeting.
Yes.
But it is important. Butts in the seat and feet on the floor are important. They need to see the faces of the people that are requesting these things. Okay. For safety and for affordability. Right. And for consistency and understanding.
Uh-huh.
Barbara, you had your hand up?
Yes, sir. This is Barbara. I would like to request that the dwell time be increased to approximately a minute during the times when we're without our newer cars, and I do hope we get them back soon. I trust we will, but there has been too many times where I and other people who I've chatted with about this have just missed a train, and it's just I would like to see it happen because there's not trains waiting to come behind them. Like, say, you know, at Roslyn, for example, there's usually a blue or silver that it doesn't take long to come up behind the orange one that just departed. But right now, in these days, they're not there. So it may be something very easy that they could be addressed, and it would certainly help a lot of the riders who, you know, who could now catch that train. Thank you.
Barbara, this relates to your comment at last meeting that when that happens, there are no benches or few benches to be able to rest on while you're waiting for these 12 minutes or more.
24, sir.
Didn't you mention that there's no place to sit down?
Yes.
Rest. So that there's the double problem. Anu, I see Philippa. Do you see anyone else, Anu?
Well, at this point, Philippa is the only one who has her hand up.
Sure.
Philippa, go ahead, please.
Yes,
hear from you. Good evening, everyone. I was just going to kind of co-sign what Ms. Rush said about feeling unsafe on the trains. I wasn't on the train. I got caught up, though, in the shooting at Columbia Heights because I was about to board the train to go home, and it was barricaded. We couldn't get on the trains. The buses were all stopped up because there were so many police cars up there. The buses couldn't get through, and I was just stuck up there for more than an hour just to try to get home before a bus finally did come. I was, when Ms. Posner talked about keeping people off the trains who have committed crimes, but I don't see any real way you can do that. Because I'll just say this, every time I go to Columbia Heights, I don't care what time of day it is. It can be 10 in the morning, it could be 2 in the afternoon, it could be 4 in the early evening. I see someone exiting that station without paying. They either crowd up behind someone who has a card, or they hop the fence, hop the little gate, they just hop over it. Some of them are just tall and skinny enough to, well, the new fare gate is up there. I think the new fare gate is up there now, but some of them just kind of turn sideways and walk through the wide fare gate, you know, the little gap. Even though the gap is smaller, they're still like stepping over it or something. And the station manager is always sitting with his or her back to the people exiting the train. And they're watching people coming into the station. So they don't see any of this, but it happens every time. It's just gotten to the point I can't believe. So anyway, but I was saying, even if you try to ban someone is my point, they find ways to get into and out of that train station with or without a fare card.
Yeah. Well, that's some time ago, the police were, the Metro Rail police were, have been prevented from dealing with fare evasion. And Phil mentions other kinds of criminal activities or bad behavior activities that that the Metro police are prevented from doing anything about also. But that doesn't, shouldn't stop us from voicing our objections to allowing these kind of incidents to continue. Anu, do you see anyone else who is looking for a moment to comment?
No, Chair Calabia, no other hands up. I would do like to take a quick moment and make my announcement for public comments.
Sure.
Anybody looking to make any public comments, you can either send us an email or call and leave a voicemail. The email is metroaacchair@wmata.com, or you can call and leave a message at 202-962-1100. And that concludes my announcement for today.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Debbie for presenting some ideas that she can use, and I ask other members to add any ideas they might want to add to the presentation on people with developmental disabilities, which we should have early next year. At the next meeting of the BRS, in January, we will hear from the designers who are working on the Hitachi 8000 series cars. And between now and then, I wish you a happy new year and happy holidays. And I hope to see you at our next meetings in January. Thank you very much. Oh, I didn't ask for an adjournment. do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Any objections to adjournment? Not hearing any. Oh, I see Phil.
I'm applauding adjournment.
Okay. Well, thank you, Phil. And thank you all. Thank you, guests. Thank you, public. Thank you, Barbara, for participating in this meeting. And we'll see you next year. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, Tina. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Just a reminder, next week is our Metro Access Subcommittee meeting. That would be our last meeting for this calendar year, so hopefully we'll see you there. Have a good and safe week.
You too.
Thank you.